We were talking this morning about 1 John and just wanted to finish up a little bit about that. In the very first verse of 1 John, he begins by saying, that which was from the beginning. And he's talking about the living word of God. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. He never has changed and he never will change. He gives us something to hold on to in the middle of all the change we see. Change and decay and all around I see, O thou who changest not. Abide with me. His permanence is certain. And this is a direct shot at the heretics with their new truth. You know, in our time, increasingly, I'm hearing people talk about my truth and your truth as though truth is a nebulous thing that we sort of make up in our own minds, and each one of us has our own brand of truth. This was a direct shot at that type of thinking. This is saying that in religion, new is wrong. Heretics have always got some kind of new, elevated knowledge that the hoi polloi, the rest of us, don't have. There's always another Book of Mormon, another Pearl of Great Price, or something of that nature. But John is talking about that which was from the beginning. At the very beginning of that change in dispensation, God gave a timeless and eternal message through Jesus Christ. And John here is earnestly contending for the once for all delivered to the saints faith. There's never going to be another faith given. The faith was given once for all, never to be repeated. So the rule of thumb is, if it's new in religion, it's wrong. Paul said, I marvel that you are so soon removed to the Galatians. The same idea. That which was from the beginning is permanent. And secondly, that which was from the beginning is sensible. In other words, Jesus, while he was here, was perceived by the senses. This faith was not cast in a mystical paradigm as though through some ethereal imagination from some man. We don't have a super-duper history that's different from real history. And super-duper history is a real expression that's used by theologians sometimes to talk about biblical spiritual history as opposed to the real history that has happened in our world. Super-duper history as opposed to real history, as though there's something different there. But no, this happened in time and space, and Jesus Christ was sensibly perceived. The faith is not reserved just for people in the know with elevated and transcendent knowledge. The word of life was available to our senses, says the Apostle John. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim. There's no secret gnosis, secret knowledge anywhere. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. John saying, I saw Him, I heard Him, I scrutinized Him, I touched Him. God became man. So don't let the heretics sway you away from that real incarnation. The Eternal One entered time and was manifest here in time and space. And there are four steps in John's sensible perception. First, he says, we heard. They heard Jesus speak. This old man who's now writing was there when he was young. He was there from the beginning of it to the end of it. He was there post-resurrection for 40 days. He says, we have heard, as structured in the Greek language, and it indicates that this hearing was not confined to any one single occasion. We have heard in a progressive, in a continuous, in a complete sense. We heard what Jesus had to say for years. We were there for the complete hearing. John's saying, I heard the Sermon on the Mount. I heard the parables. I didn't miss any of it. And the Spirit now brings all things to my remembrance from 60 years ago. So we've heard, and we have also seen with our eyes, he said. He's careful to point out that the seeing was done with his eyes. This was the physical act of seeing. There's nothing at all mystical about it. He's not saying, I had a vision, I saw a phantom appearance of a mystical logos. Not that kind of docetic double talk at all. We have seen with our eyes. I think he adds with our eyes so everybody knows. He's not talking about some transcendental visionary kind of second sight. He's talking about physical sight, just as you and I are seeing each other right now. And again, it's in the perfect tense for complete seeing. John was there when Jesus cast out the demons. He saw that happen. John was there when the lame were healed. He was there when Jesus touched the coffin of the young man. He was there when Jesus walked on the water. He was there when Jesus multiplied the loaves and the fishes. He was there. People today sometimes tell me that they have seen the Lord. I talked with one lady who told me just as seriously as she possibly could that she was driving through the middle of the night in a family emergency situation, and she was scared to death, but she said the Lord came and sat on the hood of my car and stayed there as long as I had to drive that night. Well, I just don't put any confidence in that at all. But the apostles were there. They saw him with their physical eyes, and I put a great deal of confidence in that. We have heard him, and we have seen him. John adds to that, we beheld him. It means to look long at something, to scrutinize something. This is a searching gaze. It's used in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 14, when John says there, we beheld his glory. Same word there, same idea, a searching gaze, to look long at. This means they were experiencing all of it. They put Jesus through the laboratory of human investigation. I heard the man, I saw the man, I saw the meaning, and I saw that it was God in human flesh. And he adds, our hands have handled. That means to literally to grope, to feel after, like a blind man would feel after something. I've seen a blind man take a page of Braille, and the smallest little bumps, the smallest little bends that he feels in that paper translate into meaning in his mind. That's the kind of idea here. A scrutinizing, a handling of something. Jesus used this in Luke chapter 24, verse 39, when he said, handle me and realize that a spirit doesn't have flesh and bones as you see me have. John says this was no apparition, this was no phantom. John had even leaned on his chest when they were at supper. He had 3 years to touch Jesus. So, and notice here that John is not just saying, I have heard, I have seen, I have beheld, my hands handled. He's saying, we and our, because he's including himself with the rest of the apostles who had also done these things. We were all there. We all heard, we all saw, we all looked intently into, and we all handled the word of life. God was hidden until Jesus Christ became visible. The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and in him was life. He is the way, the truth, and the life. He that hath the Son hath life, and he that hath not the Son of God hath not life. John is certain about the permanence of the Word of life. He's certain about the sensibility of the Word of life. And he's certain about proclaiming the Word of life as well. That old message that I personally experienced, he says, I am called to proclaim. Now, as I pointed out this morning, the people to whom John was writing, and we're included in that long term, but even the people he was writing to in the first century had never in their lives ever seen Jesus. Many of them had been born after Jesus was gone already. Not only that, but they lived in Asia Minor where Jesus never went. They were not witnesses of Christ. But John is credible because everybody knows that he was with Jesus. He was a legend in his own lifetime. He was the sole surviving apostle. Christ manifested himself to the apostles to qualify them as first-hand eyewitnesses so that they could pass that on to others. And when received by others, then it would again be passed on to the next generation and the next and the next. Truth once confirmed never needs to be confirmed again. You and I cannot be apostles, but we have the eyewitness testimony of the apostles. And John says it is absolutely certain that this is the true message. So, therefore, he's certain about the fellowship or the partnership, the koinonia. This is so that we can have fellowship with one another in Jesus Christ. It's a joint participation held in common. And it's more than just mere socializing. John's not saying, I'm writing this so that you can have social interaction with me. I mean, this message is to us too. How are you and I going to have social interaction with the Apostle John? He's been gone for hundreds of years. But what John's talking about here is a real partnership, a true sharing of life. He that is joined to the Lord is one spirit, says Paul, 1 Corinthians 6:17. I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. The partnership is so intimate that you and I become the temple of God, the place where Jesus Christ dwells. And John says that old gospel message is the message that I still preach. I was there. We heard, we saw, we studied, we handled that truth. We're partakers of the divine nature, sharing the life of the triunity that we know as God. This life is someday the life that's going to bring us out of the grave. So So these are tremendously important things. These things we write, he says in verse 4 that I read this morning, so that your joy may be full, that your joy may be complete. We have a certain message, a certain witness proclaiming a certain gospel, which brings us to a certain fellowship and produces a very certain joy. There's nothing like hearing it from an eyewitness. And the veracity of this epistle was settled millennia ago. Our lives should be built on the same certainties that John is talking about here. 1 John is a certain word for an uncertain age. And the first four verses deal with the certainty of the incarnation. So that is the end of the morning talk. Now, the talk for this afternoon, and I won't be long about this. Last time I was with you, I was talking about the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and I guess my sense of completion, needing completion, makes me feel like I should complete what we were talking about. Those 15 factors about love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we didn't get quite finished with that. We had three more to go. So with your kind indulgence, I'll just finish those up, and I think we can do that very quickly, and then my part will be over. But we were talking about the final four, as we called them, the final four of the 15 factors about love in 1 Corinthians 13. There's such a lyrical musicality to these that everybody could quote them. Love beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, and endureth all things. We already talked about love bearing all things, and we noted before we began into these final four that Paul is speaking hyperbolically, in other words, using the figure of speech that we know of as hyperbole. These are statements of exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. So he doesn't mean all things in the universal sense here. Love has to make some discriminations, of course. He means all things within the limitations of other correct biblical boundaries that we all know very well. Within that context, love bears all things. And we talked about that one already, so I'll not go back over that. The 13th one of these is love believes all things. Love believes all things. In other words, love is not suspicious. He doesn't mean that love just believes everything it hears. That would be stupid. And love is not stupid. So he can't be meaning that. But he means it's not suspicious. Love believes the best that it can about everybody and every situation. Love is not eager to pounce and denounce. Love is not eager to assume the worst about everybody. That's the idea here. In other words, love does not go through life cynically. Love does not say when somebody does a wrong thing and gets caught, oh, that just proves that they were rotten to begin with. That's not love's attitude. Love believes the best because it seeks the best. You often see this in the heart of a mother. A mother who, when a son or daughter drifts away from the Lord, and it's a source of great heartbreak for the parents, but the mother in particular, a mother's heart just wants to believe that they will come back to God. And that's what the way love is. Love tends to believe in you because love wants so much to believe in you. That's how hard love pulls. Love desires this so much that it just goes ahead and believes it. Sometimes what you believe about a person will help to shape that person. Have you ever noticed that? I found this to be true many times. As soon as somebody wants to make things right again, then Galatians 6:1, love is Johnny on the spot to restore them. So love is bears all things, but it believes all things in this sense. It believes the best that it possibly can about somebody, and when that somebody gives a sign of hope, then love is right there to do whatever needs to be done. Nothing is more off-putting than the desire to believe or the eagerness to believe something that's bad. Assuming things to be true that aren't true is terrible. Just because you hear something and you want to believe that it's true because it's bad and you didn't like that person anyway. That's the opposite of this quality. Love believes all things. Job's friends were the opposite of love. Job's friends believed the worst. You're a bad egg, Job. These things wouldn't be happening to you. Why don't you just fess up and bring it out? Job listened to all of that about as long as anybody could, and he had a hard time convincing his friends that they were all wrong. In fact, it took God to come in and convince them that they were wrong. Yes, love does see wrong, and yes, love rebukes wrong, and love deals with it however it needs to be dealt with. But if we err in this, we err on the side of love and not on the side of judgment. And that's the key factor here. Sometimes things are vague enough, situations in life, that we have to make a judgment call. And we try to make those, if we're going to make a mistake, we make it on the side of love, not on the side of judgment. You start hating somebody and you will soon be finding their faults. Their faults will jump out at you all over the place. But you start loving somebody, and charity is supposed to cover up a multitude of sins. You start loving somebody and you find yourself somewhat covering for them. Jesus knew the flaws of his disciples like nobody else. And yet he believed the best about every one of them. I've wondered many times, and you may have wondered this too, was Jesus ever tempted to say, Father, I don't know what to do. I've got 12 losers on my hands here. Was he ever tempted? I mean, that was true sometimes. And he even went so far as to say to them, how long am I going to have to put up with you guys? I just wonder how he really felt about that sometimes. But you know what he did about it? He gave them a job and he sent them out in the world to do it, and they did it. These losers did it after all. He made the best out of the people that he believed in the most. And he said that we should love in that same way. He put his whole plan on that basis, and they went right ahead and carried it out. He trusted them to do it. So love covers the worst, and love believes the best. Number 14, love hopes all things. Love is fully optimistic, and love just keeps on hoping, no matter what happens, because that hope is in the Lord. As long as somebody is still here on this earth and the grace of God is still operative on this earth, then human failure is never final as long as they're on this earth. Is anything too hard for the Lord? That was asked one time back in the Old Testament. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And the answer is no. Love refuses to take failure as final. God would not accept failure from Israel as final. Jesus would not accept failure from Peter as final. Paul would not accept failure from the Corinthians as final. And we ought to be that same way. Many a loving wife has held on to a husband with nothing but this rope of hope. When all your faith gets clouded in, you have to hold on to hope. Somebody said this is like being in a village beneath the Matterhorn in Switzerland and having people say, oh, it's so beautiful, you should be here on a sunny day and see the Matterhorn. But when you arrive there, it's all fogged in and it looks like there is no Matterhorn. You can't believe it's really there. Sometimes in the foggiest moments of life, you think you've made the clearest judgment about something. But then when doubt and despair begin to steal your faith, love still needs to hold on to hope. Sometimes that's about all you've got. Hope. I read about a dog in an airport in a large city. This dog had been there in that airport for over 5 years. Why? Well, his master and he had been traveling together somewhere, and his master got on a plane and took off without him. And this dog waits in that same corner of the airport. People at the airport give the dog food, they give the dog water every day, and he hangs around there and hopes. If the attachment of a dog to a man can allow that kind of faithful hope, certainly love can produce it in us when we truly hope. Love waits and waits. There are enough promises in the Bible to make our hope real. And finally, love endures all things. This is the last one. Love endures all things. You can't kill it. Endures here is from a military term referring to the sustaining of a soldier in the midst of a very violent battle. So this is a life or death term, endure. Love endures through everything like that. This is the crescendo of love. I think that's why Paul leaves it till the very last. We've talked about 14 things. We didn't talk about them all last month either. I think we talked about some the month before. So maybe hard to put these together in your mind right now. But this is on top of the other 14. This is the crescendo. Love is never totally overwhelmed, no matter how many disappointments and how frequent the disappointments. There was a man by the name of George Matheson. He deeply loved a girl, but he started to go blind. And this girl told him, "I'm sorry, George, but I could never be married to a blind man." But she couldn't kill his love. He's the man who eventually ended up writing the familiar hymn, "O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be." He had known a human love that had let him go, but he rested in the love of God, which would never release its grip. We who have the love of God shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Spirit which is given to us have that kind of love. God has already put it within us. The love of God is shed abroad in our hearts. We already have that kind of love, and that love endures. It survives. It's unconquerable. It can be wounded to the bone, but it still endures. What you and I need to do with this love is acknowledge it as a command and agree that God has placed within each one of us the capacity from God to love in this way. And we need to understand that this love is not to be an unusual kind of Christian living, but that this kind of love is to be the norm because God has placed it within us. We need to realize that it's not our work, it's the Holy Spirit's work being done through us. And then we need to go out and let it happen. We need to go out and love like this. May God help us to excel still more. May God help us to increase our love and practice it. We can each start at home to practice this love. So that's the completion, hopefully, of two lessons this afternoon. And once again, we're going to conclude by extending the Lord's invitation. If anybody is subject to it, please let us know how we can help you by coming to the front as we stand and sing.